You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. I'd like to welcome Marcela Diaz. She is Executive Director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always nice to be here.
So I haven't been on the Radio Cafe on the Santa Fe, New Mexican for a while, and it's nice to be back. And we are talking about what's going on with immigration and the global pandemic, which, of course, is a local pandemic here in New Mexico. And I wanted to talk to you about how it's affecting the immigrant community around the state of New Mexico.
Yeah, so Somos Un Pueblo Unido is a statewide organization, as you know, and we have, you know, offices and membership teams in Hobbs, in Roswell, and Santa Fe, and traveling organizers in eight counties throughout the state. And so we represent and are very much connected to families, essential workers, oil and gas workers, agricultural workers, service workers. It really runs the gamut in our community in both semi-urban areas, small cities like Santa Fe, and a lot of rural communities that are being impacted tremendously by the health pandemic, but also the economic pandemic. And so people in the last 5 months have seen serious economic issues that spill into all of these different aspects of their life, including their basic health decisions, whether they get tested, whether they go to the doctor, whether they try to get medical care. And of course, that impacts their families and it impacts public health. But I would say that the economic pandemic has just been devastating for our families. People lost their jobs. People had dramatic reduction of hours. People lost, if they had employment-based insurance, they also lost that employment-based insurance. And I think that it's important for listeners to understand that everybody, we know that this is happening to everyone. It's not just happening to immigrant mixed status families, but there are barriers that our communities face that people know about, but that are nevertheless discriminatory, racist, exclusionary in ways that make absolutely no sense for families, for children who are going to our schools, for essential workers who are such an important piece of our economy, the economy that kept running and the economy that needs to recover, and public health. So we can name what some of those barriers are. And that is that if you're undocumented, even if you're on the books and your employer pays into the unemployment insurance system, you don't get unemployment. So you don't get regular, you know, state-based unemployment. And you also did not receive any of the unemployment expansion that was provided to folks through the CARES Act at the federal level. So that's, you know, up to $1,000 a week that other folks get when they experience unemployment as a result of the shutdowns and the stay-at-home orders in the pandemic. But that's something that immigrant families did not get. We also didn't get the stimulus payments that everyone else did. So you could get up to $1,200 per person, depending on your income. But that was, you know, for most of the folks that working folks that we know got, you know, no questions asked, $1,200. Per adult, $500 per child, so that we could use that money to meet our very, very basic needs, and so that we could put that money back circulating into our economy. We've been running the numbers, and we've been getting a lot of really good information from our partners at New Mexico Voices for Children to really understand what the economic impact of that is. But of course, because we're a community-based organization, we know we know what the toll that it's taking on families and on children in our communities.
You talked about some of the kinds of jobs that have been lost, and there's also a lot of jobs that haven't been lost, essential worker jobs that come with their own risks. How is the immigrant community in particular facing those risks? What kind of risks are we looking at? Are they getting the kind of protective equipment that they need? Talk about that.
Yeah, and so, you know, we've done a lot of surveys in our community. We've done a lot of phone banking since we can't meet in person. We've been doing phone banking on voting issues and voter education as well as census work. But we're always asking our members and the community how they're faring, not just the economic issues and the health issues, but just the information that they need about their rights in returning back to work and how safe they feel in returning back to work. And in our own surveys of members throughout the state, it's clear that, you know, people feel like they're getting PPE, not everyone, but, you know, a sizable portion of our community. And people feel like there are precautions that are being taken in their workplaces. But what is concerning to folks is, you know, if there's an outbreak in their workplace, do they have access to sick leave? And in reality, a lot of people don't. If their workplace gets shut down by the environment department, and for good reason, because there's an outbreak within the workplace, and they need to, you know, have everybody get tested and wait while they get their test results back, and they do these deep cleanings, and they kind of regroup themselves in businesses. Folks who did not qualify for unemployment and who just got back to work with reduced hours and who didn't qualify for any kind of stimulus relief and probably won't if there is a second version of CARES Act, which is right now known as the HEROES Act that hasn't been taken up by the Senate in Washington, then they, you know, really have to sort of weigh all of those issues when deciding to come forward, to speak out if their employers are making them work while they're symptomatic, also to speak out if their basic health and safety are not being taken into consideration. People have to think, do I risk my life? Do I tell my employer? If I'm sick and symptomatic, do I still go to work as long as I'm wearing a mask? Because I not only can't afford not to be at work for 4 or 5 days, I also have all my coworkers to think of who would also, if there is a shutdown, have to stay at home. And so, again, this is impacting everyone, but it's particularly acute when you have no other form of economic relief. And so it impacts families, but it also impacts public health, and it impacts the ability of workers, especially if there aren't whistleblower protections in place or strong anti-retaliation protections in place. And so we just need to make sure that our communities, that our society, that our cities and our counties and our states and the federal government are really understanding how not allowing people to have access to basic relief programs like unemployment, like sick leave, like stimulus is really impacting people's everyday decisions and in whether they follow the safety protocols and whether they really do everything they can to protect the health of their families as well as their coworkers.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a perfect example about the limits of the ideology of quote unquote personal responsibility. I mean, you can't make the right decisions if you don't have the economic ability to do so. And as we've discussed many times over the years, this is a community that is already the most vulnerable community in our society before a global pandemic. And so, as you say, the lack of safety net is right in our faces. What kinds of changes are you looking at? What would you like to see?
Well, Somos Un Pueblo Unido has been working. Well, we're part of some national coalitions, of course, and we helped convene an economic relief working group here in New Mexico very early on in late March because we could see the writing on the wall, right? You know, usually as long as there are people that are undocumented, we will continue to see discriminatory policies and frankly, just racist policies that are really impacting whole swaths of people of color because the vast majority of immigrants who are in this predicament are brown and black and Asian in our communities. And so this kind of economic pandemic makes us even more vulnerable to exploitation in our workplaces. And so that's why Somos has really worked hard to get information out about what are our rights. People have been filing wage claims right now. There is some federally mandated sick leave if you've been forced to stay home while you're waiting for a test to come back, for instance, or if you have COVID and you don't get that. There are places that we are able to send people to get support and help. And we've established a small private public fund here in Santa Fe to help folks, specifically essential workers who are in the process of filing complaints, right? So we kind of call it our whistleblower support system because it takes a while to get your wage complaint, to get your EOC or discrimination complaint, or your complaint with the Department of Labor in relation to sick leave issues. And so in the process, we want to be able to provide a little bit of support to those families because, you know, they're taking risks
in coming forward and not just swallowing the rights abuse.
Specifically, what kind of wage claims and other kinds of complaints are people coming to you with? What are you seeing?
So people that have been let go in the middle of the pandemic, or they were asked to come back in and work certain hours and were promised a certain wage and then didn't get that wage, you know, employers telling them, well, you know, there are so few jobs available right now and so few hours available, take it or leave it, right? Workers that having left or having been laid off, coming back in, and, you know, they were making $16, $17, $18 an hour, and their employers say, well, now you're going to make $13 an hour. And they can do that, unfortunately. But if they are asking people to come in and they're working 2 weeks and they didn't tell them they were going to see a reduction in their wage, well, then they're not paying them their promised wage. We haven't seen many overtime issues within the last 3 or 4 months. You know, there were cases where leading up to the first shutdowns back in March, you know, people were owed money and they were told, well, you know, now you're not going to get your overtime. And they're saying, well, we don't have any other form of relief, so we want our overtime, which they have every right to ask for. They should have been paying their overtime time and a half in the first place. And people are winning their cases. There was a case at a local restaurant, filed wage claims, and the Department of Workforce Solutions looked into it fairly quickly and was able to get a settlement for them and actually get treble damages as well. You know, there were the FERS workers who were not paid their last paycheck as the shutdowns were beginning, filed collective complaints, were able to get their money, which was really, really important when nobody was working. And now with the reopenings, what we really have to be paying attention to is the health and safety precautions. And what people have said is that they want more training. They want to make sure that they're not the ones that have to force people to wear masks. The more that employers can put into place policies that protect workers and that don't put workers in the position of having to allow or turn away people who aren't taking all the safety precautions when they're going into a business, such as wearing a mask. Those are the issues that have been coming up and that people have been organizing around in their workplaces through Somos Un Pueblo Unido.
This has been the summer of Black Lives Matter, and I was wondering how the increased focus in the mainstream on racism and racist policies in the United States, which go back centuries, how that has been affecting the dialogues that you're having in the immigrant community. Are these things connected, or is there sort of commonality in organizing?
Well, we have not been doing mass protests around issues that we would love to be doing mass protests around. For instance, our exclusion from basic economic relief at every level. I think that we need to make sure that we are giving as much attention and focus to the specific issues around policing and the specific issues that impact African American and Black communities in our state as well as the country. But this conversation allows continued conversations just about the deep impact of institutional and strategic racism in our communities. We know that immigrants nationwide are very diverse. And of course, there are intersectional issues that we all have to deal with, depending on the color of our skin, whether we're Black immigrants, whether we're undocumented, whether we're refugees, whether we're mixed status, whether we're DACA recipients. I mean, it runs the gamut. I think COVID has given us an opportunity to talk about how discriminatory and racist policies have led to our exclusion when it comes to certain kinds of healthcare and testing and treatment, as well as unemployment, economic relief, and then again, how that makes us more vulnerable in workplaces. And those are policies and institutions that were there before COVID. And so, you know, Somos Un Pueblo Unido, we're always thinking about, we have many funny little mottos at Somos, and we say that our campaign work and our policy work really is about building more power, changing narrative, influencing narrative, and building power as low-wage workers and as people of color in this state, and as Latinos and as immigrants in this state, since that's the majority of our base. in New Mexico, and that the policy changes that come along with that are the nice effects of that. But we're always trying to figure out, how do we take these problems that were there all along because of these policies, and how do we use these moments of crisis to expose them? How do we use these moments to influence and shift public narrative about our lives, and to really help government think through, well, how can we help ameliorate some of the problems caused by these inequities and by these institutional discriminatory problems that we see in our policies and laws? And so one example, for instance, is, you know, the fact that undocumented immigrants, even though they're essential workers and are working constantly and paying into the system and paying taxes, don't have access to unemployment, which is crazy.
So basically, you have undocumented workers who are working, whether it's in the oil and gas industry or in restaurants or in construction, who are paying into the unemployment system and then can't get unemployment.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And so, again, when you have this expansion of unemployment, that most people who were unemployed because of COVID in this country were able to access, our families were not. I know a lot of families who, for the first time, had to line up for hours to get food boxes from places like Food Depot. And obviously, there's no shame in that, but many of our members expressed how they had never done that before. This was the first time. And there have been things like the Santa Fe Connect program. This doesn't happen in other more politically conservative communities, but the Santa Fe Connect program is a perfect example of how there's an infrastructure in place already to deal with the social determinants of health, and that is already a network of community-based organizations that are really working to support each other in supporting a large swath of families who need support in our communities, and how having that in place before a pandemic and having thoughtful leaders really think through, what do we need to help build a basic safety net program, a network for families in our communities based on so many different things, you know, whether there's a deportation in a family from one day to the next, whether there's a major health issue. The Santa Fe Connect program obviously doesn't just support undocumented immigrants, but because we live in a city where we have worked very hard over the last 25 years to ensure that we have non-disclosure policies, that we're not giving information to ICE about people's immigration status if they are accessing a city service, that we have clear non-discrimination policies, that we won't use people's status against them when it comes to any city services. And so because we already have those things in place, and because we have a safety net program in place, that we can better weather as a community pandemics. And that's not to say that we're weathering it just fine, but I can tell you that it's slightly better to live in a place like Santa Fe than in a rural community that doesn't have those infrastructures, that is politically very conservative, and that will turn you over to ICE or share your information with the federal government if you access a specific city service.
These are things that, it's kind of like when you have a crisis, sometimes you can get stuff done that you can't get done before or after a crisis, but things that you put in place now could have lasting effect. So, like, what are you asking for, and how are people responding?
Well, I love that you talk about it in that way, because we think about it in that way, right? So it's, how do we problem solve, but also how do we exploit problems to be able to undo some of the things that should never have been there in the first place, or to promote things that should have been, whether it be policies, laws, programs. We were talking about, you know, this idea of the shock doctrine, of how corporations are able to use natural catastrophes or other crises to put into place policies that make them more money and that deregulate their work in our communities. And so if corporations can do that, our advocates can do that.
And they call it disaster capitalism.
Disaster capitalism, exactly. One example, and this isn't an economic relief example, but it was clear that there was a dearth of information in Spanish for immigrants in relation to testing to the pandemic. And one of our big issues as an organization is we did not want to be giving disparate information, just kind of information from all over the place. We wanted one source of information that we could point people to. And so we wanted that to be our state government. We wanted it to be the State Department of Health. But back in late March, things still weren't done in Spanish. And so, you know, we really worked hard with some of our partners across the state to demand that and just and help our administration understand, look, we want to be pointing people to you, not to 1,000 different sources. So in order to do that, we need to make sure things are being done in our languages in a timely fashion. And the administration was very responsive to that. Immediately, we saw the Department of Health website translated into Spanish. So all of the governor's press conferences and updates that include important people in her cabinet and Department of Health to get good information is interpreted simultaneously on a YouTube channel for Spanish-speaking immigrants. So once this pandemic is over, why should that end? You know, any important information that the state have should be interpreted into Spanish so that every New Mexican can have an opportunity to get that very crucial information. And then we were trying to figure out at the state level, you know, there are between 15 and 20,000 immigrants who do not qualify for any kind of federal relief, but who are dealing again with significant shutdowns. So we really just started to think through what would a state system look like that's not cookie cutter, that's very New Mexico. So we started working with the Human Services Department to really think through and research and figured out a good program that we would like to see in place at the state level. It's looking for money right now, whether it be from the federal government, from the state, that would expand our general assistance program to provide economic relief, one-time disaster relief to not just undocumented immigrants, but to others who also did not qualify for any federal relief and who saw dramatic reductions in their income. And so in order to do that, we would have to undo some regulations that are discriminatory, that say you can't get this if you're undocumented or you have to be a citizen. And so taking those things out and lifting those restrictions would be a way for us to continue to be able to support people, not just during this pandemic, but in future crises.
So this points to the big problem, which is that the federal government is the one with the resources. State governments,
yes,
in all 50 states, I think, are suffering the way New Mexico is because of the lack of tax revenues because of the pandemic. And so finding that money here at home is really tricky. And we don't have the ability to directly influence the federal government, at least not right now. And so how do you make that case? Where do you find the money?
Well, it is true that we would not be having to spend 6 months, which we did, to not only try to find the money, to make the case, because initially nobody was talking about undocumented immigrants not having access to this money. People just kind of assumed that they did, or they just didn't think it was as dire as it is for families. And so not only did we have to do things like these reports, but we had to do roundtables with city councilors, with mayors, with our federal delegation and our members, again, to narrow that information gap so that policymakers and decision makers over our lives could just connect to people and families that were experiencing this on the ground. Ultimately, it is the federal government's responsibility to ensure that we're not excluded. And I can tell you that the HEROES Act, which the House passed, which has not been taken up, no surprise, in the Senate, does include immigrants. And that was a big feat because, again, it was not a priority, even among the Democrats initially. And that is a testament to our movement at the national level to say, hey, we exist, we're essential, we have children, and we are not only essential to the economy, we're essential to your health, to everyone's health. But the work that we're doing at the city level, at the state level, is to provide economic relief. And we've helped the city kind of figure out a good program here that we hope to get started very soon. But it's twofold, our sort of purpose with this economic relief program, even though, again, it does feel like a drop in the bucket compared to what we should be getting, which everyone else is getting through federal relief efforts and through federal relief programs. And that is to, one, undo some of the restrictions that are in place and create ways for the state and for city government and the state government to continue to be able to meet the needs in moments of crisis of its most vulnerable citizens. And so that's one purpose. And then the second purpose really is we need to be recognized. It's easy for our political allies in New Mexico to say Trump is terrible and his anti-immigrant stances are terrible and exclusion and Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans. But then we also have to put our money where our mouth is, right? When it comes to, okay, what are we going to do here to make sure that we're not excluding immigrant taxpayers from certain tax credits? What are we going to do here to make sure that we're not just giving support to business owners, which is important, irrespective of immigration status, but you know, there are also workers that need additional support. So that's sort of the message. It's just important that our cities and our counties and our state recognize that, yes, there's limited funding, but the funding has to include everyone. If not, we are being just as exclusionary and racist in practice as the Trump administration.
We've been talking a lot about policy and about what these issues look like on a state and city level. I want to make sure we talk about stories of people that you have been connecting with. I mean, there's so much post-traumatic stress in terms of money and then all the decisions that have to be made, the question of paying rent and whether or not you're going to be evicted, the question of many people are living in maybe smaller houses or smaller apartments or mobile homes where there's not the space for that privacy, so many other kinds of stress having to do with children and sending them to school and maybe not enough technology. I mean, what are some of the things that you have been hearing from your members?
Well, it varies again from community to community. We have a member who has talked to different legislators about how her son was supposed to start college this year, and they were supposed to help support with his tuition and with books, et cetera, which they were happy to do. And they said, we just don't have that money anymore. We're going to have to find that money someplace else. One of our members, Maria Jaquez from Roswell, she just had a baby who came out healthy, and that was great. But she came from Arkansas, or was it Oklahoma, where they had floods a couple of years ago. She and her husband are undocumented. Her son is also undocumented. They brought him when he was a baby. They had experienced these floods. They had a trailer, and so their trailer was destroyed. And they ended up moving to New Mexico to be with her husband's brother. And so it was one natural disaster that forced her to move. And she said, we would have stayed there. And FEMA was supporting families. And FEMA was actually even supporting mixed status families. But they weren't supporting families that were completely undocumented. And so she felt forced to move. She moves to Roswell. Her husband works in the dairy industry. He saw a dramatic decrease in income as a result of COVID. And so she went from one disaster to another, and what followed her is her status and her lack of any kind of economic relief. The good news is that her baby was born, you know, a healthy baby girl, and it's obviously a testament to our ability, our resilience and ability to survive, but it's not fair. It's not fair to her family. They're essential workers. Her husband's essential workers. She was, you know, making sandwiches and things with some of her neighbors to help make ends meet and relying on family and church supports in her community. But this is a perfect example of how the system is failing us, these very discriminatory policies that are put into place. The truth is, even if Obama were president, it's still hard to believe that undocumented immigrants would have had access to unemployment or stimulus dollars. That's just not where our country is at right now, and that's where we need our country to be.
So that's what I was going to say before we go, is what are your hopes for this time and for the, you know, for the years to come? Maybe there'll be a change of administration in January. What are you looking at? What are you hoping for?
Yeah, of course. We would love to see our communities have more power, and that's what we're working at. I share the story of Maria because Maria was making phone calls to get people to come and participate in the census 2 days before she gave birth to her daughter. And she said, I'm at home and I want to keep helping and I want to, what else can I do? It's a story of how exposed and how discriminatory these policies are, but it's also a story of lots of Somocistas who are saying, okay, and just like all of the local work that we've been doing to save our driver's licenses and to support the census and to fight back against collusion between immigration and local law enforcement, all of the things that you and your listeners probably know about Somos un Pueblo Unido, it's also in these moments, how are we going to fight back and not be erased? So in Santa Fe, in Lee, in Gallup, in Chavez, not only during this whole entire time did we continue doing get out the count work, which also is about political power and it's about money coming back into our communities. That's ours, irrespective of immigration status, despite all of this administration's efforts to not count our communities in New Mexico and across the country. We also did work to get people out to participate in the primary safely, in municipal elections safely. For those of us who can vote, how do we vote safely, use our power when it comes to absentee ballots? We're doing a virtual voter registration drive right now with members across the state. So that's how we're building power. And that's what we will continue to do. So my hope is that it all comes to fruition and that somehow we're able to see some of those dramatic changes. But we're already doing it. The fact that in Santa Fe, part of the request for use of CARES Act money is to really think about people who did not qualify for any kind of federal relief programs, both immigrant and non-immigrant. How can we meet their needs? How can we support them in any way that we can and provide some of that economic relief? And it can't just come in the form of rental assistance and vouchers. We think it's so important that we're putting money back in the pockets of families, because our families know what to do with them. Our families are best equipped to know how to use an extra $500, $600, $700, $800. That's why the rest of us were able to get stimulus dollars, because we said, look, you know what you need. Take this, recirculate that money in your economy. So our hope is that we continue to do that at the state level. And we're working with the state to help make that happen. And we're working with our city to help make that happen. And hopefully we build enough power to make some major changes at the federal level.
It's funny. I'm glad that you're talking about power in the way that you are, because some people sort of pussyfoot around the issue of power and power isn't supposed to be good, but that's just what it's all about. And mm-hmm. I mean, part of the problem in our nation now is that so few people have so much power. And what you're talking about is really distributing power in a democratic way to all the people and all the groups and all the communities in our country, including the immigrant community, but so many other people, low-wage workers and people who are working in service jobs, for each of them to actually have political power in a democracy. So thank you for emphasizing that.
Well, thank you. We do think of ourselves as a power-building organization, and so it's the only way that we can get done what we need to get done.
Marcela Diaz is executive director of Somos Un Pueblo Unido. They can be found on the web at somosunpueblounido.org. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.